My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I just have to give a little personal opinion, if you don't mind. I really enjoyed Whitney's talk. I always do. One of my favorite speakers. But whoever the people were who set up two main talks, one after another, planned badly. The last time I went to a meeting where they had a long Al-Anon talk and a long AA talk, one after another, was the 1960 International Convention. Lois Wilson talked for an hour and a quarter, then Bill Wilson talked for an hour. And it got so long that people were getting up and leaving Bill Wilson's talk. So I'm just saying, if you want to get up and leave my talk, I understand. But if you don't, you're just in a state of stunned inertia, and I'm very happy for you. I was sitting there thinking, Winnie caught me off balance. She's so effusive and so conveys things so well, and since I heard her talk last, she's introduced a poem into her talk, and I don't have a poem. You get a hold of Bob Lemke and get one of his, but let's see if I can just, in response to her poem, let me think of something. Of these things does my wealth consist: of sunset skies bathed in amethyst, of emerald seascapes roaring wild, of golden forests undefiled, of diamond teardrops glittering bright, of pearl like snowflakes drifting white. But most of all, I'm always ready for another talk from Winnie Eddy. See? Now let's get down to it. I got to be careful. I know we're on a tight schedule. It's always embarrassing for a speaker when you're just finishing your talk and they're dancing by in front of you. That son of a bitch is still going. I used to drink. And I lived with an Al-Anon, a pre-Al-Anon, and made me bald and wrinkled before my time. And now I'm in AA. I come from a different milieu than some people here, I guess. I grew up in a little small town. Although I live in Los Angeles, I grew up in a little small town up in northern Wisconsin, a little town called Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And it was a wonderful little town, the kind of town you see in Andy Hardy movies. Two-story houses, and the trees grow together over the summertime over the streets. Makes it kind of a tunnel. In fall, they rake the leaves and burn them in the streets. It's really a haunting aroma. The only time you ever smell it anymore is at rock concerts. In the wintertime, the snow would fall. It looked like a Christmas card, and little church spires and smoke coming up. And in the springtime, the snow would melt. To this day, when I smell a lilac, that says it's springtime in Wisconsin. And you know you're about to fall in love, and you hope it's with someone you like this year. And in the summertime, we'd go down to the river, and we had made little rafts. We'd go down the Chippewa River towards the Mississippi, and be like Huckleberry Finn. And it was just a perfect life. I couldn't wait to get out of that goddamn town. I just... Where have you been? I have a clue. His face is flushed. Anyway, And early in the Second World War, I had a great... had a lust for adventure, I had lust for excitement, and I wanted to be something. And one day I told my mother I was going to Superior, Wisconsin to visit my aunt, and said, I hitchhiked to San Francisco. I was 15, small, skinny, little pimply face with a dumbbell. And I thought I was smart, and I had no idea how far San Francisco was. I looked at the school map, and it didn't seem very far, page and a half about, I'd never seen a yellow state or a blue state. I wanted to see one of those. And thank God I got one ride most of the way, or I never would have made it. Some traveling salesman or something. He gave me a ride all the way from outside of Minneapolis to San Francisco. And so we'd stop at night and give me a little room. And I just took it for granted that that's the way the world went. I grew up. I had no idea what a stroke of luck. This guy was straightforward and wanted to help some dumb little kid. And I told him about how I was going to go into the Marine Corps and help John Wayne exterminate Japs. The ones that hadn't been moved over here to a camp. And he kind of, as we came into here, Oakland, he was telling me, he said, you know, son, I don't think you get in the Marine Corps there. I think you have to be, they really watch that age. You're 15 there. They want kids 17. They have to be a little bigger. Why don't you go into the merchant marine? They always crying for merchant seamen. He told me where to go. And he must have had some source. He told me to go to the Coast Guard office in San Francisco. Gave me an address. He said, tell them you're 16. And about 6 o'clock in the morning, we pulled up to the Oakland Mall. He put me on the ferry boat going across the harbor. I tell you, one of the golden memories of my life. I was dumb. I'd never been to a big city. Never done anything. I hadn't even been to Chicago or Milwaukee. And went across in the fog. And out of the fog come these hills and these spires of San Francisco's bridge. And I got off the ferry building, and he told me where to go. I walked up Market Street. At that time, there were two different competing streetcar companies in San Francisco. So there were two streetcars going each way. Four streetcars side by side. You know, plus traffic and people and tall buildings. And God, I just was sick with excitement. And I walked up to the Coast Guard office, waiting for it to open. I guess about 8 o'clock. And I walked in and I told them I won. I knew they were, the guy told me they were crying for merchant seamen. I said, I want to get some seamen's papers. He gave me a paper and I filled it out and I had put down 16 instead of 15. And I guess they were crying for merchant seamen. You know, he said, well, it's all right. You'll have to have your parents' permission. So I took the application around the block, got my parents to okay it. Brought it back, and that day they issued me seamen's papers, if you can imagine that. And I didn't know nothing. And they sent me down to the National Maritime Union down on Montgomery Street, and I schlepped down there and carried my little bag, and just sick smell of the ocean. I never smelled that before, and great things. And I went in there, and they were crying for merchant seamen. Took my seamen's papers, had me sign a waiver, said, take a union dues out of my first check. I didn't know what the hell they were talking about even. And they referred me over to, they said, well, get over to Pier 16 right away, or whatever pier it was. I took my little bag, and they showed me how to get there, and I ran over there, just agog with excitement. Here was an enormous ship, bigger than anything I'd ever seen. Now I know it's just a Liberty ship, just a dumb little ship. But it's bigger than anything in Half Moon Lake in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I'll tell you that. And I got on that ship, and they were just about to leave. I just barely got on. They hooked up the gangplank, and away they went. We went by under the Bay Bridge, and I was so excited to see that big bridge. And then we went by Alcatraz, and I'd seen pictures of that. And under the Golden Gate Bridge, Jesus, just golden moment of my life. But then we kept going. And the known Earth began to disappear in the distance. And the ship was moving around a little bit, and I hope I had an intuitive feeling that I had made the first in an endless series of career errors. All I know is I didn't feel good. And I went up to one of the officers and I said, I really appreciate this opportunity, but I should get back now. We have a big test Monday and I don't want to miss that. And he wished me well. He told me to luck off. And he said, get to your forecastle. And I didn't know what a forecastle was. It sounds ominous, doesn't it? Turns out forecastle is just crew sleeping quarters. And every one of these rooms was a watch. And I was in the third deck watch. And I went into this room and there were three of the worst type of people that a small, skinny, dumb, pimply-faced puke could ever be around. And these kind of people are called men. And they looked at me and they realized I was going to be their fourth member of their squad and they'd be carrying me all the way across the ocean. And I could feel a little tension in the room. So I told him some jokes that used to just kill him in study hall. Why don't you shut up? Why'd you get your bunk? I was overcome. I got my bunk. That ship was moving, and I felt so bad, and I really wanted my mother. But I didn't want to say anything and ruin my image. And these guys got started talking about what they'd been doing in San Francisco the 4 days they'd been there. I hadn't been there. And I couldn't believe it, because I come from a religious family. And Eau Claire, Wisconsin is a Norwegian Lutheran stronghold. And these guys were talking like they were sinners. I thought they were Catholics. They could have been. They had dark hair. And, God, it's just sinners. Talk about their sexual exploits. I want to turn my head to the wall. I don't leave the wrong impression. At the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. I didn't know these fantasies came to life in San Francisco. I'll tell you that. But I felt as bad as I ever felt before or since. One of these guys went to his sea bag and took out a bottle. Absolutely forbidden on the ship with all those old rummies he had. And he took out, turned to one of his friends, "You want a little snort?" "Yeah." "Want a little snort?" "Yeah." He turned to me and said, "How about you, Junior? Do you think you're man enough for a little snort?" He had a very unpleasant look on his face. Now that I'm sophisticated and slick, I'd have called it a demeaning look, or a supercilious look, or a denigrating look. But then there were just pleasant looks and unpleasant looks. And that was unpleasant. And he shoved that bottle in my face. Now, let me tell you something strange. I have never been in a room with a bottle of whiskey at the age of 15. That's the kind of background I came. And he shoved that bottle of whiskey. Of course, I knew what it was. And I looked up at him, and something happened that's happened to me many times in my life. There's a phenomenon, some of you know about athletics. A phenomenon in athletics called choking. That is when you're so overcome with emotion, an invisible hand comes out of your shirt. And the third strike goes by. Or you fumble a punt. Or you throw the basketball into the other guy's hand or something. But that happens in conversations, too. And I was so overcome, I couldn't say anything, because I knew I was upset. I could feel my pimple standing up. I wanted to just shout at him, but I couldn't. All I could, I thought at him. I thought, "How dare you put that bottle in my face? I guess you don't know I'm a Norwegian Lutheran. Norwegian Lutherans don't drink whiskey. And even if they did, I promised my mother and grandmother I would never drink whiskey. And even if I hadn't promised them I would drink whiskey, I wouldn't have drank whiskey because my values were predicated on what I had learned in the late 1930s and early 1940s in the movies, really, and Life magazine. And in my era, heroes never drank. Villains drank. For example, Errol Flynn never took a drink in his life, as far as I know. Never in Sherwood Forest he didn't. All with some old crap head like Claude Rains or Basil Rathbone or one of those goofs who were trying to get the Queen's secrets and sell them to the King of Spain or some goddamn thing. Buck Jones never took a drink in any movie he was ever in. Some old rustler named Slade. That's who drank.
Come on. Let's go kill Buck Jones's horse. Ha, ha, ha.
People like me don't drink. And I want to just shriek at this guy. And you think you're mad enough for a little snort? And I was trying to think of something to say, and I heard a voice say, "God damn right." And I had my first clue that I buckled quick under pressure. And that day, the first bottle of whiskey I remember seeing close up, I drank from. And it burned my mouth, and it burned my throat, and it burned my stomach, burned my stomach, burned my throat, burned my mouth, burned his shirt the last I saw of it. And what I remember most about that is the humiliation, the coarse laughter, the humiliation. Get the bottle away from the little son of a bitch. Ha, ha, ha. I'm sure you are like me. There's no feeling quite as bad as public humiliation. If you had a gun, you'd just kill someone. I had no tools. I could do nothing to them. I thought later, there was one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it at the time that it killed me. The one thing I might have done to get that big boob, I might have said, lean over, buddy.
Yeah.
Take that.
Sit.
But that's the way that cruise started out, and it stayed that way all the way, and all the way across the ocean. These guys treated me like a stupid little punk. But the way the human mind is, you got to find reasons for things. Always got to find reasons for things. Always find reasons. That's what I like about being I wish they'd start a group called the Adult Children of Norwegian Lutherans, so I could blame my parents for all that shit. But anyway, I always had the impression that they were treating me badly because I had thrown up that whiskey. It never struck me that they treated me like a stupid little punk because I was a stupid little punk. That's why. But every day when nobody was around, I'd go sneak into this guy's sea bag and take a drink of that and try to hold one down because I wanted so desperately to look like a man to be accepted that I just couldn't stand it. And I'd get sick and throw it up and I'd have to wipe it up so they didn't know. And this went on day after day. And then finally coming into Pearl Harbor, we were off watch, and so these guys were getting ready to go, and they were out down the deck, and I took a drink of that slop in Pearl Harbor, and it burned my mouth, and it burned my throat, and it burned my stomach, and it stayed down. I thought, I'll never be able to do this and smile. Oh. And I thought about it for a minute, and then something happened. It turned out a mind boggling, earth-shattering, life-changing thing happened, and I didn't have the slightest clue that it happened. It turned out that my body is one of those which are almost immediately responsive to alcohol. Some people are almost immediately responsible to alcohol. Some drink for years before they get the response. Some drink for many years. But it turned out that I had an unusual response to alcohol. But I had no way of knowing it was an unusual response and never did know. I almost died from it years later. And that unusual response I have come to learn in my sobriety is what makes an alcoholic. It isn't whether you've been in jail. It isn't whether you've been in a nut house. It isn't how much you've lost. It isn't all these things are all nice podium flash, but they have nothing to do with the nature of the illness. And that's still what kills people. The inability to understand the nature of the illness. Remember, a few months ago, I was listening to one of the most beautiful movie stars in the world. She's in her 40s now, and she still looks like she's in her 20s. And she's just so lovely. She's so talented. She sings in Vegas and dances for $100,000 a week if she wants to. She acts, and she's just beautiful. And just there's no thing she can't have her do. I hear her sort of talk at a meeting, something much smaller than this, from a podium like this and say, the reason I drank, because when I stayed sober, I felt awkward and clumsy and unattractive. And the studio insisted that I and was beautiful. And the only way I could do it was to drink. She got an unusual response from alcohol. I sponsor a guy who's used to play center for the San Francisco 49ers. Big lump. He played in the early 1950s in the kind of glory days of the 49ers. Norm Albert, quarterback. And he talks about the whole team, great team, but he and one of the guards always had to find a way back to the dressing room before the kickoff. Always have a reason to go back because he didn't feel he could block the linebackers or handle it. But once he had the pint in his locker, he knew he could knock that linebacker on his can. He got an unusual reaction to alcohol. And I got an unusual reaction to alcohol. I didn't know it was unusual. In fact, it took me years later to think back and identify what it was, really, best I could determine. Now, it's a reaction that almost to any other group in the world except AA and possibly Al-Anon, they would not understand. Because I could say it to Rotary, I could say it to doctors and psychiatrists. They wouldn't understand it. I've addressed doctors and psychiatrists and just thrown it in to see if they really get the identification out. They don't. But it's a little difference. Everyone here know the difference. It sounds the same, but there's one little difference that makes it all different. I drank so that I would look like a man. And instead, the reaction I got was, it made me feel the way men look. Which sounds almost the same, but it's entirely different. Entirely different. And years later, I found out that men don't feel as well as they look. So I was feeling better than they were, but I had no way of, I had no way of knowing that. And then I got sick and threw up, and I went back to being normal again. I'll tell you a funny, funny coincidence. Last July, I was invited to come and speak at the anniversary of the alcoholic facility at the U.S. Naval Hospital at Pearl Harbor, the Pearl Harbor Naval Yard. It's right on the water. And it was on July 8th. And I was giving, on my way over this, I thought about this, and it really sent a shiver down my spine. The day I taught, the afternoon of July 8th, I could look out in Pearl Harbor and see the spot where my ship was that I'd had my drink 44 years before that to the day. And the reason I knew it was to the day was not some mystic reason, but the day after my first drink, after I had a couple more drinks, I turned 16, and I remember on my 16th birthday I had my first hangover. And this year, the next day after my talk, I turned 60. And in many ways I felt younger than I had when I was on that ship on there. But what a spooky feeling to be able to look where you had your first drink 44 years later to the day. And I didn't become a terrible old drunk. I didn't go wild. I tried. Alcohol is like everything else when you grow up. As you're growing up, you run across things. You find things out you heard about. You discover that after a while people want you to work. They don't want to take care of you anymore. And after a while you find that love comes to you. And you find out pleasures and displeasures. You find out the world is requires you to do something to get what you want. You discover that sex was not made for fun. If it was, why would they punish us with children? I wouldn't want this tape played in front of my children. I'll tell you that. But, you know, it's just everyone, as you grow up, you find out things. And you learn things. And alcohol is just one of the things I learned. I just thought that's the way alcohol is. And you got to be careful because if it gets kind of makes you goofy sometimes, you got to watch out. And later in the war, I went in the Navy, and at the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital getting fixed up in Pleasanton, California, and they gave us some tests, so I didn't ever have to go back to high school. I'm still a junior in high school in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I went to college, the University of Wisconsin. Got out of there and went out in the world. I got married in college. I'd met this exotic girl who had black hair and was a Catholic. Like meeting someone from another planet. And she and I, we decided to get married when I was in college, and cause that's what the steely-eyed, sex-crazed killer veterans were doing. And my grandmother, you know, it's funny to think today there would be such bigotry, but she said, "Oh, Sonny, don't marry a Catholic. You'll be very sorry." I said, "Grandma, we've been over there fighting the Japanese for the right of self-determination. In the new post-war world, there's no bigotry. And there's no discrimination. We have love, and that's all we need. So I married this girl." And my grandmother was right. It's not that she was a bad girl. Worse than that, she was a good girl. She was a good Catholic girl. Fine, church-going, God-worshipping girl. And the one thing they never tell little Lutheran boys who marry good Catholic girls: you are about to become the head of a rapidly growing family. Ready or not. I guess they've chosen us to speak tonight in honor of Children's Day or Mother's Day tomorrow. And I used to plead with her. I say, "Charlotte, this is the brave new post-war world. We've been over there fighting the Japs for the right of predetermination. Not to have our lives governed by some old Italian in a dress in the Vatican, you know. Can't we use birth control?"
"No."
"How about getting something just for the prevention of disease? They sell them in a vending machine over here at Rockies." No. So she had a priest come by one day, and he gave me a long hour and a half on the rhythm system, which is the Catholic version of birth control. And I listened intently, but I just couldn't pick up that beat. I just... In addition to my other problems, I started a career as a national distributor of small Catholics. And I went out in the world, and I've got a job as a sports writer, and she kept having kids, so I'd do a better job, and I got an advertising and public relations and up and down. And I had a lot of problems, and I drank all these years. And the main reason I drank was because drinking was the best friend I have ever had. I have never had a better friend than alcohol. That sounds terrible at an AA meeting. But I'll tell you, I hate these people get up and say, that damn alcohol was always terrible and rotten and crappy. It's like hearing somebody badmouth an old girlfriend of yours, you know. Oh, she's a pig now, but she used to be nice. But alcohol, I love... Because I spend a lot of time... I've been in writing most of my life. I've been a writer, and I've always felt that I had a deeper insights than those around me, and that God had given me one great advantage. He gave me the advantage to examine myself that other people didn't seem to have. I spent a lot of time analyzing and examining myself. I thought I was the only one doing it. I didn't know everybody else did it too. But it came. I used to spend a lot of time thinking, what is it? Why do I have all these damn feelings? Why do I have these emotions? And it seemed to me there was something, an analogy perhaps, is if all human beings have been given some kind of a suit of armor psychologically to prepare them against the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, there seem to be holes in mine. I seem to have a hole, for example, in the sensitivity. I shouldn't be so sensitive to things, and I know it. But I react so strongly, and I feel so strongly about things, and things are easy to get my goat, get me upset, and it makes you crazy. And you look at other people, they don't get that way. They're, why did God make me so intelligent? I seem to have a hole over that area of my armor that covers anxiety. I have a tendency to become more anxious than anyone else in the world. And I can tell that by looking at them. They don't look anxious. I'm anxious. I get anxious a lot. I get anxious in the middle of the night sometimes when I think. And sometimes I get waves of anxiety that are much greater than any reason I can think for them. You know, that's terrible to be more anxious than you can find a reason for. You're just anxious. And it's almost a blessing when something bad happens. So you can, well, I guess I saw that coming. Yeah. I have a lot of insecurity. I have waves of insecurity. And Winnie talked about that. I get in a good, work my buns off to get in a good job. And after I got there for a while, I start getting these feelings. They're going to find me out. I don't know what the hell they're going to find out. But they're going to find me out. They're going to realize I'm faking it. They're not faking it, but I'm faking it. That's it. So you work to get a better job to overcome that feeling, which now makes you feel they're going to find you out quicker. Yeah, you know, endless goddamn trauma. One thing I noticed years and years ago, I have a different form of loneliness than people. And it makes me crazy sometimes. Because I don't hear people say, well, I was kind of lonely, but I called a friend and we had a good night together. God damn it. When I get lonely, really lonely, it makes me depressed. And when I get depressed, I withdraw. Which makes me a little lonelier, which makes me a little sadder, a little more depressed. And this spiral continues for 2 or 3 days, and eventually the time comes, and it's come many, many times in my life over the past years, where I just refuse to get up in the morning. Just pull the covers over my head. And it's hard to justify that. What are you doing under there? I'm lonely. Of course you're lonely, you boob, you know. There's not much you can do then. If you, last defiance you got, if you can find the top of the covers without releasing your head. And you know, other people aren't like that. I remember sitting in a big advertising agency in Dallas, where I was a hot item briefly at that time, and listening to my secretary talk on the phone 30-some years ago. Yes, I was lonely last night, and I called up Betty, and we went to the show, and had a wonderful time. I remember just sitting, thinking, looking at it, thinking, I wish I were simple like you, you bitch. What in the hell is wrong with me? And I went to psychoanalysis as soon as I could afford it. A lot of people today say you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. I made breakthroughs there that staggered me. I discovered why I had many of these feelings. I discovered I'd been repressed as a youth. I hadn't known that. Didn't have any material things as a child. I didn't know that until I got psychoanalysis. When I found out, it made me pretty sad, I'll tell you. One of the classic stories I've said many times, the best way I could remember one day the doctor saying to me, he said, you mean to say, Mr. Emerson, in 1935, period we're talking about, you didn't even have a bicycle? I said, no. But I got thinking about it on the way home. I begin to remember, I never had anything. For about 2 months after that, every time I wanted to throw myself into a terrible depression, all I had to do was visualize in my mind's eye a little tousled-haired, apple-cheeked, blue-eyed little tyke standing on the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, watching his little friends ride their bicycles to it. Don't worry about me. I'll go into analysis later. Took me almost 2 months to remember. In 1935, nobody in Eau Claire had a bicycle. One kid did. We thought he was a freak. We beat him up and broke his bicycle. But I discovered why I had deep senses of rejection. Because my parents had, we were teachers, and they had to go to other way cities to teach. And I'd live with my grandparents. I never remember. I was glad to see them go because I loved my grandparents. They gave me anything I wanted. My parents were mean, I thought. But later I found out that when my parents left, I felt rejected. God, I came out of there. Sometimes I'd come out of there, or that psychiatrist's office, just have a big drink. It's amazing I'm doing as well as I am, for Christ's sake. I discovered a lot of things. And later on, a few years later, when I was on the faculty of the University of Texas, and I was going through more sophisticated, deep problems, I got into metaphysics then, and I found another new series of reasons why I was wrong, emanating from the fact that my oneness extending into the universe had not found a sympathetic chord. I read books, I read Nietzsche, did all the things imitation intellectuals do. I just studied it. Because all my life, I've been under the guise, if I can find out why I feel this way, it'll get all right. And I found out why. And then I found out why again. And I found out why again. I'm sure there's a lot of people in this room who are looking to find out why you feel these feelings. Let me give you some information. You can find out why, and it doesn't help. There's a certain feeling of ecstasy briefly, but then the ecstasy goes away, and now you feel crappy, and you know why. The only possible use for the information is late at night in a bar. Some guy will say, "Hey, what the hell's wrong with you?" And you can tell him. Turns out they don't want to hear it. I've tried a lot of things over the years. When I found out one thing in Pearl Harbor in 1943 that served me in good stead. When all else fails, a few drinks fills my holes better than anything I have ever known. And that's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a sensitive, feeling, sometimes mask-ridden person. Living in a world, most of my life I lived with something, and I'm sure most of you live with it. And I never knew about it until I was sober a while, and I heard a guy talk about it in his inventory that I was listening to. I almost resented the little puke for knowing more about it than I did. I gave him some penance, I'll bet it. But here, this, you think about this, how because of my emotions and my introspection, I have spent most of my life under the with the feeling that they are what they seem to be. I am the only one faking it. I am the only one having to change my posture, to change my defense mechanisms. They are just what they appear to be. And it took me almost all my life to discover that isn't true. They are all humans are like me to one extent or another. But it's hard to understand that. Because, you know, it's hard to realize other people use defense mechanisms too. You assume that that's just the way they are. And the world is full of defense mechanisms. And every human being's got them. Alcoholics may have more of them. And they vary from all kinds of things, from the super intellectual, you know, what we've been talking about. Did you ever read Nietzsche on that subject? No, I didn't think you had. Keeps him away. To the way to the other end of the spectrum, the guy who says, I got a new Harley and I'm going to run it up your ass. Yeah. Same thing. Same thing. And all the tools in between. But I've spent my life thinking, I am the only one faking it. They are what they seem. And I discovered when I drink alcohol, that it makes me feel the way they look, as though I know what I'm doing. I feel, when my holds are filled, I'm a better worker, I'm a better raconteur, I'm a more jolly father, I'm more fun around the house, I'm more fun at work. I'm just, that, and it never, I never thought I was getting anything unusual. I thought I was just catching up to what the rest of them had all along. Who would ever know? But I filled my hold with spirit. There's only one problem I've ever had in my life with it. I have an unfortunate tendency to overfill my holds. And I don't seem to have any runoff mechanism for this overfill. And it goes to the electrical works. And a new change takes place. And I have a tendency to become sometimes what judges and policemen have described as bizarre. Now, there's nothing wrong with being bizarre when you're a kid. That's kind of fun, you know. Boy, did we have fun after the prom last night. We had a pint and I went over to the hotel and peed in the hotel lobby. But as you get older, being bizarre becomes a handicap, I'll tell you. You stop enjoying being bizarre. So I worked very hard on against being bizarre. And I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. That's before some of you little snots were born. Remember this, young folks. You're the AA leaders of tomorrow, and I'm so glad I won't be here to see it. I could barely make it to the ones that are here now. But I went to AA, and AA had served no interest to me because there's a bunch of old fools sitting around talking about how they're drunk, you know. It looked like God's waiting room. That's what it looked like. Yeah, just wait for some voice to say next, and one of them. Besides that, they all kept saying again and again, your problem is alcohol, you're in the right place. And I knew that my problem was alcohol, but that wasn't my number one problem. My problem were my sensitivities and my feelings and the way people treated me. And so I went to AA for a little while, and this went on. And for years, I went to AA every so often. In the early 1950s, I was having a lot of problems, and I went to psychoanalysis and got out of there. And I started drinking heavily again. And at that time, AA was kind of a mystic thing. And I could come home, be it come off a terrible drunk or something, and tell my wife, Charlotte, I've gone back to AA. And she'd say, well, maybe it'll work this time, honey. I say, you know, they want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Allen on them to screw it up for him. Ever since Al-Anon has been functioning, it's been just a hideous life for slippers everywhere.
What do you mean? They want you to take Rob. We have our program, too. We know about you. You're done. We're done. We're leaking you up. No, 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 no.
I did a lot of things. And I had to. And then I was consumed with guilt and try hard. All of my life, I have been a champion 50-yard dash man. For 50 yards, I can be the best you'll ever see. I'm a good employee. I'm a straight shooter. I'm smart. I'm slick. I'm doing everything. But there's no race that runs for 50 yards. The rest of my running is some kind of a marathon out there today. And I could do good for a while, and one day start to think, these people are using me. I'm too good for these people. They're screwing me around. And that's the beginning of the end. Pretty soon I'm in jail somewhere, and they're saying, you're gone. One spring, I was nominated to be Junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year in a suburb of Chicago. 10 months later, through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, I was playing piano in a cheap bar in San Francisco in a hotel where girls kept taking guys upstairs, and only the girls ever came back. I don't remember those guys. Great place though for a Lutheran and see what's going on. Then I came out of that with terrible, terrible guilt, and I ran to a guy I'd been in the Navy with, and he hitchhiked to Texas, and I got a job in a paper there, and I got a job in an advertising agency, and I did so well that a year and a half later I was working days at an advertising agency, nights on the faculty of the University of Texas, writing a weekly sports column. My wife and children moved down. 9 months and 10 seconds later, boom, a little Catholic hit the streets in Texas. I was really doing good. And then I was in the spring, and the pressures mounted, and one day I couldn't hold it together. And through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, 3 months later I was committed for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life in the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas. And I wasn't too, there was nothing on my commitment paper said alcohol at all, because I hadn't had a drink. Pregnant. And I had to have that insurance, so they told me at the university, you can't drink, you've been down, going out of Mexico and raising hell, and you can't do that. So I went on the wagon, I went back to AA, I got the medicine, did all sorts of things. I'll tell you, when you get sober, that's when you know you're not really an alcoholic. Because the pressures come back, the anxiety, the tension, feelings of difference, and all these kids, that I love them, but God damn it, they're just making me crazy. And pressures and 3 jobs and trying to make up for lost time all the time. And one day, I couldn't stand it. My wife took the kids to church, and I didn't know what to do. I couldn't drink. All I did was I parked the car in the garage and shut the door, hooked up the hose, turned the motor and went to sleep and died. That's the best I could think of. I just can't stand it. And I died, and then the neighbor heard me motor running and kicked open the door and pulled me out and beat on my chest, and they rushed me to the hospital and transferred me a couple days later to the psych ward and examined me for 2 weeks. Talked to my loved ones and all my employers and so on, and determined that I was a badly split personality, a psychopathic schizoid. Funny, huh? When I get to the part where I get leukemia, you like that? This is a tough group up here, I'll tell you. A man just died, and you go, Gentile bastard. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, when you wake up and find yourself, well, you're trying to hold things together. And you want your kids to have a good home, and you want your wife to be happy, and you want my parents, I was their only child, they were so heartbroken about like these jams. And to wind up and find yourself committed, perhaps for the rest of your life, to a state insane asylum, it just gives you a feeling that this is going to really screw up your resume. How will I ever work this in? Well, fortunately for me, the next spring, after my shock treatments, they put in an alcoholic ward in that state, Tecate Nuthouse.
And I was able, because I'd been going to AA off and on for 7 years by this time. I knew how to play those old fools. And I pretended to be an alcoholic, got transferred finally to the alcoholic ward, finally got out as a recovered alcoholic. And one of the things I wanted to do, I wanted to go back to that psychiatrist that, and just grab him by the shirt front and say, "You idiot. You call yourself a psychiatrist. You're the, that's the worst diagnosis I've ever heard, calling me a split personality. Christ, if I get my personalities down to two, I can make it." Yeah. My problem has always been this committee that forms at the drop of a hat.
What do you think we better do? No, I don't know. Let's get the hell out of here. Do you think we can? I don't know.
I hear people in AA say they needed group therapy. Not me. I just go for a ride alone in my car. That's one of the things drinking does for me. It gets it down to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's the one voice.
Why don't you quit your job and punch the son of a bitch in the mouth?
When I got out of that nut house and people thought I was cured and I had a job, a big job in Dallas, the largest advertising agency in the South Front called Tracy Lock. In a couple of months, they thought I was the most brilliant little thing they'd ever seen, and four guys and I were sitting in a little bullpen writing these ads. Some of you read them, the old Kelsey and Elmer ads for the Borden Company, all these cows talking to each other. And the pressure was on. I had to my wife, I was signed out of the nut house to her. That's how they did it in those days. She had to file a report every Saturday night on whether I was acting funny.
Jeez.
That adds a lot of fun around the house. "Don't you think you better take the garbage out now, Clancy?" "Good idea, honey." "Why don't you bite yourself and get rabies?" And I was trying to hold it together, and we had another baby, 9 months and 10 seconds after we got home to the nut house, and a show came on television, and then I thought, Jesus, that's all I've ever wanted. Because I'm really square down deep. I'm the square guy. I just want things to be right. There's this new program called Father Knows Best. I used to, when I could, I'd try to watch that. I think, that's what I want out of life. You know, that's what I'm made for. But these things running around here, that, there's no princess or none of Bob, none of the, his kids are around here, princes and no Bud. There's things running around here, screaming. And that thing in the kitchen isn't Jane Wyatt, I'll tell you. It's pretty tough to be Robert Young alone in Dallas, Texas. So it built up, and one day, much to my surprise, it exploded. I didn't mean it to. I got it, didn't want it to. But I went off to a terrible drunk. I lost my job. I knew my wife turned me in. I had to get out of that state. I came back to my house. She had moved, taken the children, sold the furniture, and gone. And my clothes were laid on the floor. I grabbed those. And a month later, I woke up one morning. I was in the Phoenix, Arizona drunk tank. I was laying on the floor. A guy had just got done kicking my front teeth down my throat. He said I had just vomited on his bunk. And he called. You find many masochists that you have to play with? And that was one of the few mornings I was ever glad I'd been in psychoanalysis. It all paid off that one morning. Because when you've been in psychoanalysis, at least you have ways to put things in perspective. That morning, as I lay on the floor, too sick to move my head out of the way of this guy's shoe, I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. And I'd lost my clothes by that time. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't go back to Texas under anything because I knew I was going to go to the nut house and get shock treatment. And about a month after that, I found myself being thrown out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles. Thrown out of a Skid Row mission. And I was trying to tell her that I'm not a bum. I'm not a bum. I'm a talented guy. I'm a good writer. An ad I wrote is running in Life magazine right now, if you can get a copy. I've directed a grand opera at the University of Texas. I'm a sensitive, creative guy. But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood in front of that mission, dying. I'll tell you, if a guy would have come along and put a lie detector in my arm and said, "Are you an alcoholic?"
based on everything you know? Not, no, I'm not. And that needle wouldn't have quivered a 1/16 of an inch. By that time, I'd have been glad to be an alcoholic. If being an alcoholic, if stopping drinking would make it better, I'd have stopped drinking 1,000 times. I stopped drinking a lot of times. But unlike alcoholics, my problem is not really alcohol. Sometimes it looks like it is, and that's what people can smell, but that isn't what it is. And one morning it was a cold rain, and I walked 71 blocks out to the AA Club in Wilshire and Fairfax. And Bob also used to be around there. And where I'd been asked to leave 2 weeks before, because there was some coffee money missing. And I felt terrible about that, because that seemed so damn unfair, because the guy that got most of it didn't get caught. Have you ever noticed how that goes? Some people just go through life. And the guy didn't want to let me in, but finally let me in. I lay in the back. I slept in the abandoned car in the AA Club parking lot that night. I thought, I'm going to have to do here what I did in Texas. I'm going to have to pretend to be an alcoholic, no matter what it takes. I'm going to have to fool these old fools because I can get some teeth and get it back on my feet and be something. Because I'm smart as anybody. At least I don't have a family holding me back now. I can make my move. And I hung around that damn club, and I went to meetings all the time. There's nothing else to do. The only time I ate, a lot of days, with coffee and cookies and cake.
Get a sponsor. Get a sponsor.
So I got a sponsor. The guy seemed to be a rather chummy sort, and it turned out he wasn't. He was a power drunk, egocentric sadist. There he was. I tried to reason with him. He said, "I don't want to hear what you've got to say. You live in an abandoned car." He made me take, I think, one of the worst things of my life. That first few months, he made me take action that humiliated me even further. Because up until now, I may be down and out and I may have lost everything, but goddammit, I've got my integrity. And he was selling out my integrity piece by piece, making me pretend to be interested in pukes that I wouldn't even talk to if I had my power about me, and taking jobs that I wouldn't hire someone to do years ago, and on, telling me to do things. Go do that. I don't want to do that. Nobody cares. And he would intimidate me. That's what I hated worst of all. He intimidated me. When you're secretly weak, there's one thing you hate, is to be intimidated. When you're strong, you enjoy being intimidated. But when you're weak, you hate it. I've come to that conclusion. And I remember sitting thinking a lot of times at meetings, thinking, when he comes in tonight and says, "Clancy, I'm not going to be intimidated." I'm saying, "Yes, Bob." And see what the old son of a bitch says. And I'd be standing there thinking, he went behind me and said, "Clancy." I go, lie awake thinking about it. And he got, one day I was going to commit suicide, and he took that pain and made me write an inventory and said, "Just sick things like that." And somehow during that year, no thanks to him, but I started to get better. And little by little, I started to feel a little better. And when I was 2 years sober, I had a little job. I was able to hold a job when I was a year sober in an advertising agency. Not a writer, I was wrapping packages. Until I was 2 years sober, I had a little job as a writer in a medical corporation. And now I had some money saved. "Bob, I'm going to get some front teeth at last. I need them for this job." He says, "Send that money to your kids. You haven't had any money to send them for hardly for 2 years. Send that money." "Send my money? Christ, they got front teeth." "So I don't care. Just send them. Try to act like your father, even if you can't be one." So I sent him the money. I had to learn to curl my lip like this. A lot of people didn't know I didn't have front teeth. They just thought I'd been burned in a fire. But I went to work every day. That was my first year there. It was when I was asked to come out to West Covina and share on Christmas Eve because they couldn't get any decent speakers. They got a toothless old fool. "I'll tell you what's wrong with goddamn Christmas. It's shitty. That's what's wrong with it." And these guys liked it. That tells you about them, huh? Well, by the time I was 5 years sober, I finally had front teeth. I was director of advertising for that corporation. Now, 7 years sober, another guy and I went into Hollywood, and we created the number one hard rock station in the world, called Boss Radio, which just all wore shiny suits. Said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" Aren't you Sonny and Cher out of my office as talentless people? I said, you'll never make it. And, I guess they had some success after that, but you notice today they're not together. I was 10 years sober as downtown doing public relations with the oil company. I was 15 years sober as a marketing director of Beverly Hills. I was 5 years sober with the same wife, all those children, heard the crinkle of green in my wallet, all the way to a post office box in Dallas, leaped out of the post office box, rushed to my side, attached themselves like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later. I could tell you stories that would make tears roll down your cheeks. Isn't that a nice story? True. In fact, the next Sunday I'm going down to watch one of those kids get a master's degree. And a couple weeks after that, watch another kid graduate from college, the last one, the last little AA baby. I'll tell you, he was raised a Catholic, of course, and played football for St. Monica's High School, Catholic High School in Santa Monica. And I ran the 10-yard chain. Sportsman, and I also am a good father. And I remember when they played the Lutheran in high school, I was so glad to be a schizophrenic. I just get them Catholics, get them Lutherans. I cheated for both teams. It's a nice story, but let me tell you one more thing. All of this is true. But if you're a guy like me, when I was new, it doesn't mean a damn thing. It's just another one of those endless, interminable success stories. Another guy is wonderful, and I'm still crappy. Let me say, the most important thing I've said tonight, or I'll say before I sit down, no one paid any attention to it, nor should you. But I'll say it one more time. I said, my name is Clancy Imslin, and I'm an alcoholic. That was the single most difficult thing I ever had to come to believe in my life. I did not believe I was an alcoholic when I was drinking. I did not believe I was an alcoholic when I got sober. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic after I was sober. I could swap drinking stories with anybody. But I am not really an alcoholic. I'm a different type than they have around here. There's something different about me. My emotions, my feelings. And I had to take these actions as a nod. I took them as a... laugh to myself, think, maybe this makes alcoholics feel better, makes me feel humiliated, and on and on. And over a period of time, I took actions and did things and went to meetings and tried to follow along, and sometimes for the rottenest of purposes. And over a period of time, maybe in a year or two, little by little, something, I began to learn something that has changed my life more than anything I've ever known except alcohol. Alcohol changed my life significantly. And this, little by little, this didn't come fast. This came piece by piece, like the world's hardest jigsaw puzzle, I'll tell you. Because you get a little piece, and there's nothing around it. And you get another piece, another meeting. That doesn't fit anything but over here somewhere, right? It takes a long time before you find pieces of, oh, why, it's a horsey. You get a lot of pieces here, and it seems like it's a waste. But I had to come to overcome the biggest problem I've had, and I'm sure there are people here who have. How can you be an alcoholic when your problem is not really alcohol? When it looks like it is, and you can say it is, but you know it really isn't. There are worse problems than the alcohol. And the information I had to survive long enough to discover, and I hope you listen, because it almost cost me my life to learn this, I had to come to understand that if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And conversely, if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not alcohol. Doesn't that sound upside down and weird, some kind of a cult thing? But I believe it. I believe that book is written to that extent. I'm one of the few people in this room, I'm sure, old enough, who sat with Bill Wilson, asked him if that's what he thought, and he said that's what he thought, too. He said, but how can that be? Of course the problem is alcohol. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If the problem is alcohol, detoxes turn out winners. And they don't. Hospitals turn out winners. Treatment centers turn out winners. Jails turn out winners. And they don't. If getting sober and being sober is the answer, there is no need for organizations like the one we are in tonight. You get sober and you shape up. What is it then, if it isn't alcohol? Well, it's something that sounds like alcohol. and we talk a lot about drinking, and it's easy to be confused. And there are people dying every day because they have it confused in their mind. We've been to AA. It's something that sounds like alcohol, but it isn't alcohol. There's something called alcoholism. You say, what the hell's the difference? Is that the debater's trick? Alcoholism? Same thing. Not the same thing. If you can come to understand it is not the same thing, you've got a chance to survive. You say, what's the difference? Differences are, well, let me give you an example. A couple of years ago, the psychiatric convention in Orlando, Florida, asked me to come down there to talk on the differences between alcohol problems and the disease symptoms of alcoholism. They were alcoholics. I felt almost ashamed to go down there because I thought I could tell them the answer over the telephone. Then I thought, if I do that, I'll never get to Disney World. Let the old fools pay off, I say. But I can tell you in one sentence and you will understand it. The difference between an alcohol problem and the disease of alcohol is this. In an alcohol problem, stopping drinking brings the remedy. But in the strange, denigrating, destructive, eroding, sanity-threatening thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking has no significant effect on you except to gradually make you feel so bad you cannot stand it. I thought I heard my grandma. Make some homemade root beer, Grandma. I'll be home soon. But it sounds kind of strange, doesn't it? But you know, the lethal part of the disease of alcoholism is sobriety. And yet we're conditioned to think all of our lives getting sober is what makes it better. That's what makes it worse. You can feel good for a while, but one day here come your old pals in 2 a.m. through your window and door, anxiety and tension, feeling different and the knowledge they're screwing you around again and things aren't working out. People that you'd like to have care for you don't care for you, they care for each other. The world is full of selfish people, the world is full of unfairness, and it's just so crappy. And if I do it, they did have any chance, it's too late now anyway. It's all so screwed up and on. But that doesn't make you an alcoholic. That gets you halfway there. That makes you what science describes as an intense or acute neurotic. A person who lives in reality but reacts obsessively and badly. One thing more must be present to be an alcoholic. And I never knew this till I almost died. I never knew anybody who told me it. You have to have an unusual reaction to alcohol. Well, we've all heard that. The question is, what is the unusual reaction to alcohol? Well, some people need you to think it's if you stay drunk all the time, that pretty much indicates you're an alcoholic. You hear guys get up and say, I drank and stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years. You think, now that guy is an alcoholic. But then when I was working in the medical corporation, I ran across something funny. It is physically impossible for a human body in a laboratory under controlled circumstances to stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights. The body will not stay intoxicated. It will not accept any more alcohol. In fact, that's really the rottenest part about being a drinker when you think about it. Getting sober all the time. Hideous. Oh, yeah. Just hideous. If you could stay drunk, we'd have a very small dinner tonight. We'd have a different speaker, I'll tell you that. I'll be out in the Chinese palace in Wada's Chihuahua. Here I am back again, you lucky spicks. Well, is it maybe the reaction is this. If you're an alcoholic, you can't handle alcohol. That sounds reasonable, doesn't it? False. Alcoholics traditionally can handle alcohol better than non-alcoholics any time. If you as an alcoholic have ever been to a social event where you and social drinkers drank the same amount, I'll bet that you will drive them home. The trouble is you can't get them to drink the same amount. They say things like, no more for me, I'm starting to feel it. Why don't you feel this, wimp? Worst night of the year to be out. We talk about this in West Covina a lot. Worst night of the year to be out, what? New Year's Eve. Because all of those social drinkers are out there drunk, and they don't know how to be drunk. Anyone in this room that's an alcoholic has at least 15 to 20 seconds to know you're going to vomit. You just recognize it. Anybody got a cert? Those people, those social drinkers, don't even recognize you. You're going to be talking to them.
And then I said to Billy, I said, bleh!
People like us go, they fall down. I don't care if roadblocks do. We have a lot of them in California. Where the traffic goes out, tries to catch them in the holidays, catch drunken drivers. They're not trying to catch alcoholics. They're trying to catch non-alcoholics who are drunk badly. They're out there bumping into cars and posts. While decent citizens like you and I sit behind them and say, hurry up there. Is it maybe the unusual response is alcohol makes you act bizarre. That's what makes you an alcoholic. Sounds right. You hear a lot of bizarre stories. False. In my job today, I see alcoholics die almost every day. Most of you never have that experience. I see it almost every day and see alcoholics go irreversibly insane. And some of these guys never been bizarre once. The more they drink, the more introverted they become, until they become almost catatonic. It's just the opposite. What the hell is it that alcohol does to me that it didn't do to my parents? It doesn't do to any of my children. In fact, it's almost humiliating today. Because everywhere I go today, there is somebody who says, well, now my son Billy's in the program 2 years, and little Francie's in treatment, and we have a real AA family. I go home and look at those natural, normal little pukes, and I, what's wrong with you? When I was your age, I was in the insane asylum. But what does alcohol do to me? It doesn't do to them. Nothing. Nothing. In fact, it does less to me than it does to them. To this day, if I were willing to die over it, I could drink them under the table. I might have to get sober again, but I could do it. Then what is this unusual reaction they keep talking about? And here's the $64,000 answer, folks. If you remember this, you got a chance. Because when I began to understand this from my betters, it saved my life. It isn't what alcohol does to me at all. It's just the opposite. It turns out it does something special for me that it doesn't do for most people. And they don't know it does it for me, and I don't know it does it for me. But what does it do for me? It almost instantly alters my perception of reality. Boom. The thing that I, when Winnie was talking, she was fine till her husband had that drink, and then he became unresponsive. Reality changes. I'm no longer under your beck and call, babe. Boom. It almost instantly changes my relationship to my environment, where the hell that may be. It almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening to me. It almost immediately fills my holes. And it turns out only about 5 or 6 people out of every 100 drinkers get that reaction. And it's the greatest feeling you ever have. It almost is temporary omnipotence. And the only thing wrong with it, if it does that for you, your chances jump then to about 97-3 that you will die from it. That's the funny thing. People die from it every day. I'll tell you something sadder than that. A number of people in this room tonight, sober and happy, will die drunk. Because that's the nature of this illness. You think, how could that be? Because all you have to do is go back to allowing yourself to feel different long enough and stop taking simple actions that don't seem to be making much sense. But it turns out there's a name for this condition where sobriety is untenable and alcohol brings an answer, and now alcohol becomes a problem. That is called alcoholism. And you drink till you get sober, and you stay sober till you got to drink, and you drink till you got to get sober. You get sober, you got to drink. There's no time element. If you got that, you're going to die from it. You're going to die whether you have $10 million, because there's no way to buy out. People go to treatment centers again and again. Can't understand why. What the hell is it? And the loved ones say, why are they like that? He has everything to live for, and yet he goes back to drink. They don't know that conflict is being resolved. And the guy doesn't know alcohol doesn't do it for anybody else. So if I have to drink, that means you don't have the troubles I have. And it's absolutely a disease of misperception. And the reason that's important to know is so that boobs like you and me will not come to these rooms and sit here and stay sober a while, then begin to feel bad and think AA doesn't work. The natural state of sober alcoholics is anxiety and depression and tension. Anything apart from that is progress. The purpose of AA and its steps, not sitting in a room talking about deep subjects, its steps, its actions, its doing the things, not knowing the things. God, that's hard to learn when you're an imitation intellectual. Because I can know a subject quick, but knowing it isn't worth a pitcher or a warm spit around here. You got to do it. You got to do it. And I hope if you're lucky, you'll have a sponsor who intimidates you a little bit. Because you will take more actions for an intimidating sponsor than you ever will for a pal or a chum. Well, I don't want to do that, Archie. Okay. Wherever you see enthusiastic, strong AA, if you go there, you will find a strong sponsorship ethic. Because strong sponsorship ethics gets people to take actions beyond what they would normally do left to their own devices. But the purpose of all of AA is to what? What are we here for? To make you holy? Nah. To learn to understand God, perhaps? Nope. If that were true, I've been flown across the country 3 or 4 times now to talk to a big home in the East where they send clergymen from all over the world who weep in frustration because they love God and they can't stay sober. And AA's run a home that teaches them how to take 12 steps that will enable them to love God and stay sober. And yet, in our meetings, we find someone who barely is able to pronounce God suddenly decides he's God's messenger on earth and is spiritually superior to all of this crap. Screw him. No matter how hard you work the program here, you never rise above human being. You never will become perfect. The purpose of AA is to what? Become, understand the nature of alcoholism? That helps a little bit, but only to keep you going. The function of AA, I've come to believe, much to my surprise over the years, the function of AA is to little by little do the only thing that I needed alcohol to do. Alcohol did it fast. AA does it so slow it's almost imperceptible. It's designed to gradually change my perception of reality, to little by little alter my relationship to my environment, to little by little fill up my holes. But I'll tell you something. AA will never fill your holes the way alcohol does, because alcohol gives you an unnatural filling. Human beings can't fill their holes. You get them up there, they're up and down. That's part of being a human being. You will always have emotions. What AA helps me do, keep them from becoming lethal obsessions. But you will always have emotions. What are you talking about today? It happens to me. Remember in 1970, I was pleased to be asked to speak at the International Convention in the Miami Beach. On the noon of July 4th. God, I was so thrilled. I was sober 12 years or so. And the first speaker that morning was the guy that took me to my first meeting in Eau Claire, Wisconsin in 1949. And the last speaker that night was Chuck C., who was my current sponsor. And I thought, my God, it's... And I came back from there just walking on air. And I thought, I have found the spiritual experience I need, and no more upsets, no more problems. I'm going to live at peace with the world. And the next morning, I was working downtown in advertising agency, got my car, got that set on the freeway. I felt transported. I just transformed. I came onto the San Diego freeway, and a little old lady in a Toyota came off the freeway and missed me by about a 1/16 of an inch. And the new spiritual leader of the West Coast had his window down there. You silly bitch in a goddamn Toyota! God damn you! And I thought, well, I'll go to a couple more meetings. But unlike Winnie, the difference between Al-Anon and AA is this. Over my years in AA, gradually I have learned, I still chase people. I don't know why, because you can't do anything when you catch them. And you go by them and give them a ray. But I never chase them past my exit. That's what AA's done. If I haven't caught them by 4th Street, I say, good flying, Red Baron. We'll meet again. Last year, I came by, a girl almost killed me, and I came by her and gave her a triple ray. And I looked at her, she was just a little girl, about as old as my granddaughter, who was 18. And a little long, flowing hair, and sweet. And I thought, here's a little girl, she's probably learned to drive, and here's an old curmudgeon, son of a bitch. And so I, what am I doing? I smiled at her, and she went... She almost went to visit my grandma for root beer on that record. But that's the nature of life. That's why I keep going to AA, because there's a lot of bad people out there hurting me. And the greatest... That's what AA is about. You know what AA is about, really? Is to little by little keep them looking all right. Because I don't change, but when I don't go to meetings to do these things, I stay the same. But they all go to hell and act funny and talk funny and get weird. And I got to go to meetings and they shape up gradually. So that's what I'm asking you to do. Go to a lot of meetings as long as you live, not for your sake, but to help them. There's really only two bad times, dangerous times in AA, I think. The first is in the first 90 days when you're just looking for some way to hang on. And the other is all the time after that. It doesn't mean it's bad, but it can be dangerous if you don't do these things. Because the purpose of AA is to little by little fill up holes that only alcohol can fill. There's one more thing I want to say. I know I'm talking over. God, am I ever... Well, who cares? This is where you got any place to go. St. George. Today in AA, as for as long as I've been around AA, I've been hearing this from 1949 even. It's always been here, but it's even a little stronger today. The voices on the perimeter of AA who say things like, well, AA is all right to get you sober. But if you have deep emotional upsets, you need something much more intense than AA. AA is nice, and they mean well. Have you tried therapy X or therapy Y that will teach you that your parents caused all your problems? Or maybe you could take medication Z and it's a breakthrough. On and on and on. Because AA is not enough. Let me say this. I have been in jail 34 times. Not a record, but it's good for an executive. I have been in a veterans hospital padded cell, cold sober. I have been chained down to a bed in the city hospital while my wife came into that hospital, had a baby, and went home again, and I was still chained there. I always felt she induced labor to humiliate me. I have been committed for the rest of my life to the Texas State Insane Asylum. I think I can speak on behalf of the emotionally upset. Speaking on behalf of the emotionally upset, let me say this. AA, as it is, if you keep doing it, and hopefully have an intimidating sponsor, and hopefully open your mind to a growing awareness that God first exists and then is not trying to kill you but wishes well for you if you let him. If you continue to take these actions and never get so busy, you don't have time to give a pat on the back to someone behind you. If you keep doing these things, AA, as it is, works at least 29 and a half years. It may not work any longer, but I can tell you from personal experience, it works 29 and a half years. And it works good. So if you don't have 29 and a half years, try it. You'll be surprised. Thank you.